presented in this session is minimizing casualties, Brigham Young, T.E. Lawrence, and George Bush looking for a good war. The presenter is Donna Littleford. Donna has a B.A. in English from Cal State L.A. She, for the past 6 years, has been the effects production coordinator for David Allen Productions in Burbank. She resides in Downey, California, and is particularly interested in this topic as she has written a screenplay on the Utah War, and this was a natural extension of that. Our commenter, after Donna gives her remarks, is Oren Parker. Oren has extensive experience in the Middle East. He is a retired member of the board of directors of American Mideast Educational and Training Services, AMID East, and he's on the advisory board of National Council on U.S. Arab Relations. He spent 28 years really with AMID East, 19 years overseas in Greece, Turkey, Iraq, and Lebanon. So he has extensive experience in the Middle East. I'd like to turn the time over to Donna now. She will present for about 35 minutes. Oren will comment for approximately 10 minutes, and then we'll have question and answers after that.
Thank you. Because my paper is longer than can comfortably be read in about 30 minutes, I am going to have to summarize quite a bit of it and maybe skip a few things. But I have brought a few copies. If anyone's interested in them, you're free to have one afterwards. Okay. A significant feature of the coalition forces strategy in the Persian Gulf War was to minimize casualties, particularly their own, but also Iraqi non-combatants and even enemy soldiers where possible. Few generals desire heavy losses or would admit to inflicting large numbers of casualties unnecessarily, but seldom does the avoidance of killing or being killed during a war become such an integral part of the overall political struggle. Karl von Clausewitz, the foremost military theorist since 1833, was an evangelist of absolute war, or of putting no limits on the application of force. He wrote that if one side uses force without compunction, undeterred by the bloodshed it involves, while the other side refrains, the first will gain the upper hand. To introduce the principle of moderation into the theory of war itself would always lead to logical absurdity. The coalition proved this analysis to be incorrect. The Allies sought to minimize death and destruction, even though Saddam Hussein utilized tactics of total war, yet the Allies prevailed nonetheless. The strategy of minimizing casualties can be traced at least as far back as the 3rd century BC to Sun Tzu, a highly successful Chinese general. His offensive strategy, as outlined in The Art of War, might be summarized as follows. To capture the enemy's army is better than to destroy it. To subdue the enemy without fighting is the acme of skill. What is of supreme importance in war is to attack the enemy's strategy. Next best is to disrupt his alliances. The next best is to attack his army. The worst policy is to attack cities. Thus, those skilled in war subdue the enemy's army without battle. They capture his cities without assaulting them and overthrow his state without protracted operations. The strategic, political, psychological, and spiritual advantages of employing a strategy of minimal casualties were demonstrated in the campaigns of two significant predecessors to the Persian Gulf War, the Utah War of 1857-58 and the Arab Revolt during World War I. Initially, these three conflicts would seem to have little in common. However, for example, the technology available was different and motivations varied. But despite these disparate features, the tactics used in each of these conflicts were remarkably similar and resulted equally in success. The first war that I'll talk about, they go pretty much in chronological order, and the first one is about the Utah War. In 1857, the federal government sent 2,500 United States Army troops out to the Utah Territory, and Brigham Young called up the territorial militia in order to oppose their entrance into the territory or into the valley. Young boasted that if the United States wanted war, he would so manage affairs that none of our boys will be killed. A correspondent to the New York Herald gave the casualty list succinctly. Killed, none. Wounded, none. Fooled, everybody. The conflict did turn out to be a bloodless one for the most part. I mean, those who, there were individuals who died during the war but are usually considered non-combatant or, you know, not actually casualties directly of the war. The first phase of the war occurred in the fall of 1857. It was an operation of harassment. Several companies of Utah cavalry called scouts, rangers, or bandits cut down trees and burned the grass before and for sometimes a mile on either side of the road. And this, of course, made it difficult for the army to find forage for their stock animals and their draft animals. And over time, this weakened what was their principal means of transportation. During night raids, the rangers went near and sometimes brazenly through the army camps, yelling and banging on pots and pans and knocking down tents. This interrupted the soldiers' sleep and intended to wear them out over time. This tactic of sleep disruption is a common tactic, and jumping ahead to the Persian Gulf War, it was also used there. It was one of several reasons for lobbing the Scud missiles on the Durant, the coalition airfield at Durant, or on the Allies' part, their practice of nightly bombing raids on the Iraqi bunkers. Going back to Utah, the raiders stampeded the army mules and stole their cattle. Again, this disrupted their transportation and also the army's food supply. Major Lott Smith was given a specific assignment to either turn back or destroy the army supply trains. And eventually, three wagon trains with a total of 73 wagons were burned. And this did cause the army to resort to rationing of their food supplies in order to have enough until springtime. The common soldier lived on 10 ounces of flour and 4 ounces of fat pork per day, and they received coffee once a week. Throughout their raids, the Mormon militiamen maintained a policy of non-engagement with army troops. Lott Smith reported that his orders were not to hurt anyone except in self-defense. One of the reasons they were able to get away with this was that the 2nd Dragoons, or the Expeditions Cavalry Unit, had been delayed in Kansas. There were a lot of organizational problems in the Army getting out on the plains and getting to Utah. And by so doing, it took the Dragoons about 4 months before they actually caught up with the advance units. Colonel Alexander complained in a letter to Governor Young about the tactics that they were using, and he characterized them as beneath the usages of civilized warfare. Young interpreted this complaint as that they want us to form a line of battle in an open plain and give them a fair chance to shoot us, which of course they never did. The soldiers were trying to shoot the Mormons, but they did not have a lot of success at that. They did shoot two horses out from under a couple of the raiders, but that was about it. And also artillerymen would fire at them. What happened is the Mormons liked to get up on the bluffs overlooking the army camps, and they'd sit up there. Of course, it was out of range of the cannons, but sometimes the artillerymen would shoot at them nonetheless. Much as the United States begged Israel to stay out of the Gulf War, Brigham Young also had to beg his, or at least request the Ute chieftains of the area to stay out of their conflict. One tactic that is essential to the minimizing of casualties is deception. Sun Tzu wrote that all warfare is based on deception. Probably the Mormons' most successful deception was in the masking of their true numbers. Lott Smith and the raiders used tactics such as riding over rough ground. Sometimes he'd send the men around, you know, hills again and again to make it look like he had a larger force than he had. With no more than 20 companions on one instance, they were able to burn supply trains guarded by up to 60 or 70 armed men. Major Joseph Taylor and his adjutant William Stowell were captured by the Army and became POWs. But during that time, they were able to exaggerate the number of men guarding Echo Canyon, which, of course, was on the main road into the Salt Lake Valley. From 1,200 men who were actually there at the time, they bumped it up to 20 or 30,000, or made them think that there might be as many as that in the canyon. This myth was continued later on when Governor Cumming went into the Salt Lake Valley. He was escorted through Echo Canyon at night, and General Daniel H. Wells had campfires built all up and down the canyon on the hillsides, and then have the militiamen who were there to, he'd sort of recycle them again, and they would salute the governor, and then they'd run down the canyon and then come and salute him again, and over and over. This perception that the Mormons had fielded a far more formidable force than they had did contribute to the delay in the confrontation. Instead of trying to go through Echo Canyon, the Army tried to hack out a road up Ham's Fork and sort of stumbled around trying to do that for a while. And when that wasn't very successful, then they had to come back. But in the meantime, the snows started coming, and they were delayed that way. Another important tactic for minimizing casualties is to try to subdue the enemy by making it your friend or by causing it to desert. The Mormons did have tactics. They were trying to cause disaffection in Army troops, and there were over 400 desertions, or at least by one report, they estimate over 400 desertions during the Utah War. It's difficult to say how successful the Mormons' tactics were in that figure because the desertion rate was high in the U.S. Frontier Army anyway, even during the peacetime situation. Young's final tactic for minimizing casualties was a mass migration of the people out of the Northern Territory. This was in preparation to burn their homes and their orchards. Reasons for this was threefold. The one reason was to keep their enemies from occupying their homes again, as had occurred in Missouri and Illinois. A second reason for this was the physical removal of the people from the possible invading army. And the third reason was in the propaganda and the sympathy that they hoped that this move would generate. Reasons for the trying to minimize casualties are fairly clear. The first was that they had relatively small numbers. There were only about 40,000 white settlers in the territory at the time, and only 6,000 available troops. And of those, only about half of them were actually armed. The Mormon people also had moral and spiritual reasons to avoid killing. And there was a concern that because not all of the soldiers hated them or were responsible for being out there, that there might be a danger of taking innocent life if they were to just massacre the force indiscriminately. But the most compelling reason seems to be the effect they hoped that sparing life would have upon public opinion. And Young sent this communique to militia officers in the southern part of the territory. Save life always when it is possible. We do not wish to shed a drop of blood if it can be avoided. This course will give us great influence abroad. Young knew that the war was also being fought in the newspapers and in the halls of Congress back east. There was a sizable number in the population who questioned the wisdom of sending an armed force before investigating a peaceful solution. Young's choice of tactics reflects his savvy handling of a difficult dilemma. Destroying the U.S. troops could only bring more forces and reprisals against the people. At the same time, he wanted to keep them out of the territory long enough for diplomacy to work or for something to turn up, quote unquote. The militia's harassment campaign and masking of their true numbers aggravated what was already a poor organization on the part of the Army. These delays, it delayed them long enough that the Army did get caught in the winter snows and had to go into winter quarters. By the time spring came, President Buchanan had a change of heart and appointed a peace commission to take a pardon for the Mormon people. How great a part did the Mormons' tactics, specifically minimizing casualties, play in the president's decision? It was more an indirect role than direct. The immediate cause for the president's change of mind, according to historian Norman Furness, was the Congress of the United States. The president had requested more volunteers and also to appropriate more money for the unanticipated expenses, but the Congress either stalled or just ignored his request. Over time, other problems became more important. basically, and then he chose to explore a peaceful solution. The Mormon strategy played a role, nonetheless, in the Congress's delay. As the Captain Van Vliet, who had visited Salt Lake City, went back to the nation's capital, he raised doubts as to the necessity of a battle. And one writer in the New York Tribune commented on the significance of the avoidance of bloodshed. In point of law, the shedding or not shedding of blood might make no difference. In point of sentiment and feeling, and of action stimulated by sentiment and feeling, it makes a great deal. Brigham Young has sense enough to know that as great as is the existing antipathy against him and his people, a conflict commenced by his orders in which the blood of the United States soldiers should flow would greatly aggravate it. Also, a writer, a Times reporter, a New York Times reporter, who had been in Salt Lake when the great move south occurred, wrote this: "There are no more Mormons left, either to fight us or to obey us, as they are abandoning our territory en masse rather than submit to our rule. We have made a desert and called it peace." And I found that ironic because there was a newspaper columnist who during the Gulf War also used that same quote, "We have made a desert and called it peace." Even if the Mormons could not influence Buchanan directly or win the sympathy of a majority of citizens, they won enough sympathy and raised enough questions to delay action in the House and Senate, which delay caused the president to rethink his strategy. Although Clausewitz dismissed trying to disarm or defeat an enemy without too much bloodshed as naivete or fallacy, where the mistakes which come from kindness are the very worst, the evidence indicates to the contrary that an enemy can be dealt with without the shedding of blood. Humane tactics can win favorable opinion or influence, which can be brought to bear in seeking a political settlement. But more than a propaganda tool, minimizing casualties can be a moral and spiritual element. It creates an environment which allows for a nonviolent solution to be considered or explored, while avoiding the consequences which bloodshed can unleash: heightened passions, desires for retaliation, etc. For a greater understanding of these intangible advantages, it's useful to look 60 years later to the Arab revolt, who fought the shooting war the Utah rebels avoided. Because of the time factor, I am going to skip quite a bit about the Arab revolt, but one thing I enjoyed reading about it and learning about it because it did remind me quite a bit of the Utah War in its various elements. In one example, both the Mormon militia and the Bedouin force observed morning and night prayers throughout the war, and this religious aspect to it was interesting to me. Under the leadership of T.E. Lawrence, the Arab warriors minimized casualties. Sir Alec Kirkbride wrote that Lawrence's ideal of waging war was based on the professional condottieri of medieval Italy, who, because they fought fellow paid mercenaries, gained their objectives with a minimum of casualties on both sides. His efforts to minimize casualties benefited the Arabs far more than the Turks. However, there are incidents that show that Lawrence did have compassion for his enemy. He was generally scrupulous to halt the killing as soon as an objective had been achieved and avoided absolute war or orthodox battle tactics, which he termed murder war. Some of the reasons for using these tactics, again, one of the reasons was the fewness of the numbers of rebels in the beginning of the revolt. And another reason was the morale factor. "The Arabs fought for freedom," Lawrence wrote, "and that was a pleasure to be tasted only by a man alive. Posterity was a chilly thing to work for, no matter how much a man happened to love his own or other people's already produced children." The Bedouin tribesmen did fight in the form of warfare to which they were accustomed: raiding, skirmishing, hindering, which are basically guerrilla tactics. Lawrence decided it would be far more profitable to destroy the enemy's equipment than his army, since materials were scarce and therefore more precious to the Turks than manpower. The Arabs would fight a war of detachment, directed against his stuff, quote-unquote, mining his railway along the many stretches of vast desert. By never engaging the enemy, they would never be a target, and yet contain him by the silent threat of the unknown desert, and never knowing from whence they would strike. Meanwhile, the most important battles of the war were being fought in the tents of Sherif Faisal and his emissaries. It was a battle fought with a weapon the Turks could not defend against: the idea of Arab independence. A province was won when the sympathies of the inhabitants were won. The presence of the Turks was secondary. Garrisons and posts guarding the road to Aqaba were taken by surprise, diversion, and Bedouin audacity, resulting in no more than two losses. Elusive demolition operations to the north drew significant numbers of enemy troops out of the true target area. By the time the rebels reached Aqaba itself, the remaining contingent of 300 Turks had drawn itself in and were in a panic, conscious of its vulnerability from the interior, since all of its defenses were facing the sea. They fought tenaciously for some hours, but were finally convinced that surrender was preferable to starvation or massacre. Over the next year, similar tactics were employed in stepping stones towards Damascus. Each day brought a flood of visitors to Lawrence's tent, seeking to be on the winning side. In the majority of battles, Lawrence did his best to follow the principle of minimizing casualties. The occasions when he abandoned this principle haunted him the rest of his life. One of these occasions occurred in the town of Tafila, and in this instance, Lawrence wrote that he resorted to orthodox, what he called orthodox military defenses, in order to show off new Arab strength. And his comments about his choice of tactics in this occasion I found illuminating. This was villainous, for with arithmetic and geography for allies, we might have spared the suffering factor of humanity, and to make a conscious joke of victory was wanton. We could have won by refusing battle, foxed them by maneuvering our center as on 20 such occasions, before and since. Yet bad temper and conceit united for this time to make me not content to know my power, but determined to give public advertisement of it to the enemy and to everyone. By my decision to fight, I had killed 20 or 30 of our 600 men, and the wounded would be perhaps three times as many. It was one-sixth of our force gone on a verbal triumph, for the destruction of this 1,000 poor Turks would not affect the issue of the war. I use Lawrence in this part of the paper to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. It's fairly evident. It seems fairly evident to me that Lawrence did suffer from that disorder after the war and through the rest of his life. It's been estimated that from a quarter to up to perhaps a third of the 3.5 million veterans of Vietnam suffer from some form of post-traumatic stress disorder. And if you think of those types of numbers and think about their wives and as well as their children, extended family members, and add those type, you know, that magnitude of numbers to the usually quoted casualties from war, you know, the dead, the those requiring hospitalization, the disabled, and what have you, then you get a more accurate picture of human suffering resulting from war. And in the paper, I do raise the question, this would be an interesting study, whether a policy of minimizing casualties could save soldiers and their families from not only physical wounds, but the psychological scars as well. Despite his own lapses, Lawrence hoped that future generals would learn to fight what he called thinking wars and abandon the barbaric mass destruction of strategic orthodoxy. 70 years later, across the desert from Lawrence's own battlefield, the world saw the strategy of minimal casualties employed in a major land conflict. The Persian Gulf War was not a guerrilla war, as in these other instances, but a major deployment fought by forces of from 600,000 to 700,000 allied troops and from 500,000 to 700,000 Iraqi soldiers. Nevertheless, the casualty figures have been characterized as almost miraculous. And at the end of the six-week war, less than 200 Allied troops had lost their lives. The civilian casualties were also remarkably low compared to previous major wars. Without exact figures, they have been estimated at from a few hundred to up to a few thousand in a little over a month, compared to an average of 137,000 civilian deaths per month during World War I and 388,000 civilian casualties per month in World War II. The highest casualty figure is that of enemy troops killed. Although the exact number will remain a mystery, original estimates of up to 100,000 dead have been reduced after questioning of Iraqi POWs revealed that there was a lower death rate from bomb attacks and a higher desertion rate than allies expected. As in the Utah War and Arab Revolt, the Gulf War was a highly mobile, detached, and deceptive campaign. George Bush was adamant about applying the lessons learned from Vietnam, whose principal lesson was to give commanders free rein to win a war. And yet there were many political considerations that had to be a part of the equation, not least of which was the precarious nature of the 28-country coalition, or the danger of the United States being viewed by the world community as a superpower bully. The coalition needed to generate and keep support for the war on the home fronts during a time when peace sentiment ran high. The Congress passed its war resolutions by narrow margins, 52 to 47 in the Senate, while the House vote was 250 to 183. On January 13th, barely 51% of Americans favored immediate use of force. In Europe, there were massive peace demonstrations. In the Arab and Islamic allies had many spiritual and cultural ties to Iraq and its people. They did not wish to see Iraq annihilated. Minimizing casualties, and then there's also the Western ideals of morality and ideals of belief in a measured response in war. And these brought together, minimizing casualties became the answer to some of President Bush's hardest political questions. Like the Mormons and Arabs before them, the Allies targeted principally the Iraqis' stuff, their equipment and materials, their communications and transportation, their ability to make war. The new technology that we've all heard about, the laser, video-guided bombs, computer-programmed cruise missiles, played a large part in the avoidance of civilian casualties, delivering payloads with up to 80% accuracy. North Vietnamese foreign laborers flooding Jordanian refugee camps from out of Baghdad noticed the difference in this more surgical bombing compared to the indiscriminate destruction over Hanoi. It's important to note here that to carry out a strategy of minimizing casualties requires very much an excellent intelligence program. And I go into that a little bit, but for lack of time, I'll move on. The advantage of their most exclusive use of air power during the majority of the war was its ability to apply destruction with relative impunity. Out of 70,000 sorties flown, only 30 Allied planes were lost. During the 100-hour ground war, Allied generals avoided frontal attacks, opting for fast sweeping flanking maneuvers and tank and artillery duels at a distance. In the case of the M1A1 tank, its effective range was twice that of the best Iraqi T-72. That means the Americans were lobbing their shells without ever being in danger of return fire. The Allies also fought a war of deception. And, of course, we've all heard of the Phantom Amphibious Operation, and massing for attack along one border and then sneaking the troops away to attack in a different place. The Gulf conflict was also a war of propaganda, fought on TV, radio, and in the newspapers around the world. Mostly there was a lot of talk about the number of casualties. Daily war briefings would show these missiles flying through the doors and windows and showing that this was leaving less collateral damage in their wakes. Saddam Hussein, for his part, capitalized on the misses, showing the bombed residential buildings and the injured children. What was interesting is that when there wasn't enough exploitable collateral damage, we started getting these curious disputed reports, and you had the arguments over whether it was a baby formula factory destroyed or a chemical factory. The mystery of who was blowing up the mosques. Was it the Allies or Hussein himself? And this peaked with the infamous bombing of the civilians' shelter. And to this day, I think there's a lot of question as to whether the Allies' intelligence somehow went wrong, or whether Hussein actually put civilians where he calculated they would be hit. Revealing both their level of confidence and the importance of minimal civilian casualties in the propaganda war, the Allies actually considered announcing bomb targets ahead of time to allow civilians to make a wide berth. What they did tell the Iraqi people was that the safest place to be was at home. Saddam Hussein, for his part, opted for tactics of total war. And we know he called for an Islamic jihad. He unleashed the Scud missiles on population centers, paraded abused captured flyers on television, blew up Kuwaiti oil wells, implemented scorched earth policy, and took thousands of Kuwaiti hostages. These types of tactics win few friends. Only the Palestinians, Jordanians, and Yemenis were the only ones to give Hussein support, and there was talk of war crime trials. On the other hand, an example of the sympathy and goodwill that a nation can gain from restraint is the case of Israel's non-retaliation in the face of continuous Scud attacks. And eventually this opened a door, or helped open a door, to an unprecedented regional peace conference. Coalition efforts to subdue the enemy were much more successful. They included the heavy bombing and also the thousands of leaflets dropped on the army soldiers. We're aware of the steady flow of deserters during the air campaign, rising to 65,000 surrenders in the ground war. It wasn't until after the war that we learned of the effects, of the psychologically debilitating effects of the B-52 bombing that were far greater than the Allies had expected. Desertion rates during the five-week air war, according to Iraqi commanders, could have reached up to 40%, or up to 200,000 enemy troops, explaining why Allied forces found many bunkers totally empty or undermanned. There were many reasons for the lopsided conclusion, and also why these tactics of minimizing casualties were successful in this occasion and also during the Arab Revolt and the Utah War. I do realize that, and discuss in the paper, situations where it may be more difficult to implement this type of a strategy. There are disadvantages that I discuss as well, that compromise is necessary to be committed to that kind of a tactic or strategy. This paper is meant to be primarily thought-provoking, that if generals and politicians were encouraged to use their ingenuity, perhaps this strategy could be more widely and to better advantage. For example, the coalition did have weaknesses. Had the Allies not maintained the almost miraculously low casualty figures, there could have been a far more trouble at home and a rougher diplomatic road. As Utah's leadership realized in 1858, no bullets, artillery, nor even smart bombs can differentiate between the thugs and those enemy soldiers who have no choice in being there. No officer will want to spare the enemy if it will put his own men at risk, and yet a duty to spare the factor of human suffering demands that the search continue for ways of reducing enemy combatant casualties, as well as the civilian and one's own, especially when the stated enemy is the opposing leadership and not the people themselves. But it may take nothing less than the Rivets concept of war, where weapon systems fight only against other weapon systems before the factor of human suffering can be reduced adequately. As General Schwarzkopf recognized, no casualty figure is miraculous to the families of those who do die. There are psychological, spiritual, and moral, as well as propaganda and military advantages for minimizing casualties. Sun Tzu declared it was the acme of skill to subdue the enemy without fighting at all, but in the event of battle, to achieve victory in the least destructive or costly manner. It is also the honorable thing to do. Confirming that coalition bombers would not target civilian areas, even though the Iraqis began parking tanks and planes and command centers in residential neighborhoods, General Schwarzkopf stated emphatically, "We are not going to reduce ourselves to that level of moral conduct. Guys in white hats don't do that." Imagine the benefits of sympathy and goodwill from world opinion if rebel and insurgent groups in Central America, Africa, or Northern Ireland practice strategies of minimizing casualties. In many cases, minimizing casualties will be the more effective military strategy. The problem with the bombing of Dresden was not only that it was murder war upon civilian populations, but also that it was ineffective warfare. Pounding civilian populations in an attempt to demoralize them is seldom successful. Such punishment galvanizes a people against their foe. A far more effective strategy for bringing Germany to her knees in World War II was the bombing of industry, transportation, and energy resources. In short, Germany's ability to make war. One wonders if detonating an atomic bomb first in a less populated area might not have been just as effective in ending the war with Japan as was dropping ones on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It is my hope that thinking wars will become more common in the future in the event a war must be fought at all. In one of Utah's war councils, their religious and military leaders recalled the now obscure words of the Russian general at Sebastopol. "We have maintained the honor of defense in such a manner that our grandchildren may recall with pride the remembrance of it and send it on to all posterity." There may not be such a thing as a good war, but by applying a strategy of minimizing casualties, it is possible to maintain one's defense by a course both advantageous and honorable.
Uh, Donna Littleford's presentation has been very substantive and it's been very provocative and certainly very well researched, and I think of real value in assessing what some of us see as our government's policy of believing that they can use massive military force to solve other people's problems and sometimes some of our problems, and not always very successfully or very seldom. For someone like myself who opposed the Gulf War and who believes that it, like our heavy military adventures in Panama and Grenada and in Libya and in other places, have not really produced a challenge. The only good war is the absolutely necessary war, and minimizing casualties has become something that we have become very good at as long as the casualties we're talking about are our own. Brigham Young's almost pacifist stance at the time on war generally, of course, and at the time of the Johnson Army incursion was of course devoted to minimizing casualties and in order to protect what the Saints had built in the Utah mountains and to secure their hard-won community. This was a necessary war in the sense that it required some kind of strategy to meet the army which was prepared to come in and take over. Interestingly enough, my grandmother's first husband, a man named William Alpheus Simmons, was a casualty of that situation. He was commissioned to form a company, and they were testing the motley collection of weapons that they'd collected up in Emigration Canyon, with Simmons on one side having instructed his men to use these various weapons, shooting over to his side so that he could observe the trajectory and the range of them. Well, the first shot killed him. So either his men were very good shots or they were bad ones, or they were very good ones, I don't know which. But we know that Brigham Young, along with most of us, of course, who have been a part of a shooting war and have seen the waste and murder of war up close, know that there was and will be no good war. He said, "God never institutes wars." And again, he said, "Does it justify the slaying of men, women, and children because a great army is doing the work? No, the guilty will be damned for it." That's from Brigham Young Discourses. T.E. Lawrence felt, of course, just as strongly opposed to war as President Young, but he was caught up again in one of the necessary wars. And also his mission was to help people free themselves from a yoke of oppression and occupation that had lasted for over 500 years. He probably sensed early on that his mission was a false one and that his government would not keep its promise of independence for the Arabs. And, of course, we now have strong evidence that Britain's chief interest in freeing the Arabs from Turkish rule was to provide England with first access to the region's newly discovered oil fields, oil reserves. And that, of course, brings us quickly to the real reason for the Gulf War, which, of course, was to make sure that the oil reserves of the Persian Gulf remained under Western influence. But at any rate, T.E. Lawrence tried to put a civilized break on the savage killing practiced in Arab-Bedouin warfare, and there's no doubt that Al-Lawrence, as he was called, was personally against unnecessary killing. I would think that were he alive today, he would have been strongly against the Gulf War. And, of course, Lawrence is not a hero to the Arabs. If you read the Arab side of the story, it's quite different than our own, and he's regarded as a tool of British imperialism that helped to mislead the Arabs and to deny them their freedom. But where I disagree most with Miss Littleford is her thesis that George Bush was devoted to minimizing casualties. A true policy of minimizing casualties would have dictated at least a few more months' delay before beginning the hostilities. What was the rush to start the killing? Iraqi forces, we all know, were growing weaker, not stronger. Why not just a limited air war to destroy the weapons and strategic bases? Why institute such all-out destruction? It's almost a misnomer to call the effort a war. None of us here can remember any battles in the Gulf War, can we? There were none. Not really battles. We had double the number of troops of the enemy, which is now estimated at only 250,000. I've read estimates indicating that there were only 250,000 in the beginning. And, of course, many of those did desert. That reduced it. And, of course, our fighting equipment in the air and on the ground was so far superior that it's not even worth trying to make comparisons between the force that we had assembled in the desert against the Iraqi force. However, in spite of having opposed the decision to go to war, I, along with most Americans, was proud of how efficiently our armed forces performed their beautifully coordinated operations and how impressively they were able to use their deadly weapons. We were also very impressed, I certainly was, by their public relations. But that worries me. Recently released Pentagon reports indicate that the long days and nights of the air war and the softening up of front lines were not seriously constrained by any policy of minimizing casualties, nor was the merciless bombing and strafing of Iraqi troops and civilians who were fleeing Kuwait City on that highway that has been called the Highway of Death. A policy of minimizing casualties would have provided leaflet appeals telling Iraqi soldiers and others to leave their tanks and guns and would have allowed the cars and trucks to leave on that highway unbombed. This is only one example of many. We were all very spellbound, I think, by the smart bombs that seemed not to be killing anyone, but the numbers of civilian Iraqis, and I would challenge the number that you quoted here, the number of military who were killed in this war is not known yet, really. And it will someday come to light, just as the casualty figures on the Panama War came to light not very long ago, sometime after the hostilities, to show us how very deadly that war was. Neither the Iraqi government nor our own government want these figures, of course, to be known at this particular time, and the press has been very mild about trying to follow up on what are the actual figures. When they come out, I think we will all be surprised and abhorred. It will be an abhorrent figure. At any rate, the people who were killed in the Gulf War were not responsible for the invasion of Kuwait. Basically, the people of Iraq in the Gulf War were punished for not being a democracy. And then, as they attempted to overthrow Saddam Hussein at the end of the action, the coalition decided such a development would be too risky, and this two-bit dictator then was left with enough force to maintain his iron-fisted rule, and still is there, and not really any answers yet, certainly not to the problem of Saddam Hussein. I think it's wrong to attribute the current Arab-Israeli peace talks to Israel's decision not to retaliate against Iraq. Israel's at the peace table because the U.S. insists, and because the U.S. promised the coalition that it would bring Israel around. And if a settlement is produced, it will not be because of the Gulf War, but because the U.S. finally used the strong influence that it has with Israel. Now, this is the kind of political and economic influence that we can use to prevent war. Someday, we'll know the facts behind the sudden decision in November, a year ago, to declare the embargo ineffective and a decision to opt for the shooting war, even though most of our experts were against it. I think that all Americans were very proud of President Bush's leadership and Secretary Baker's leadership in bringing about the world's first coalition of a very large and influential number of nations committed to use economic and political force to punish and to reverse the aggression. This, to me, was truly the New World Order, and I was proud and I was excited and anxious to see that succeed. And so the sudden decision for an all-out war was a double outrage to me because it meant that we would not see if this great peaceful experiment would work or could work. We're now back to square one, where aggression and international piracy are only to be solved by war. And war does not solve problems. If we review all of our recent wars, we can't see a one that has solved the problem that it was intended to. Instead, it always creates additional ones. Kuwait, though no longer occupied, is still not democratic and is expelling the very people who built their nation. Iraq's former stability is now almost destroyed, and the area has major new problems with a resurgent Iran that is establishing ties now with former Soviet Muslim states, and all kinds of new elements of dissension and difficulty are present in the Middle East, some of them as a direct result of the war. Many of us who know Iraq and the Middle East are convinced that the embargo would have brought about a withdrawal from Kuwait and the downfall of Saddam Hussein as well. In modern history, the one thing that an Arab leader must provide to his people is some kind of economic viability. He has to feed them. He has to provide the necessities of life for them. And when President Bush made Saddam Hussein his preoccupation, daily preoccupation, from the time of the invasion of Kuwait right on through the war, he built the man up to be a hero to the Arabs. And that was Saddam Hussein's purpose in the whole exercise. That was his purpose for going to war with Iran, and that was his purpose for moving into Kuwait, to make himself the pan-Arab hero, the hero of the Arabs, the modern leader of the Arabs. And President Bush gave that to him. How much better it would have been if we had simply followed the UN and let the UN make the statements about Iraq and have, at a press conference, our president say nothing about Saddam Hussein, never mention his name, never give him any attention. Stood up to the superpowers, and the Iraqis, of course, will get rid of him eventually, hopefully soon, but their task is made more difficult, I think, by the war. It's intriguing to speculate that our leaders may be reaching more civilized levels in their war-making, but given the awful power of modern weapons, as I witnessed firsthand in Lebanon for a number of years, warfare each year brings to us new dimensions of horror and carnage. And we as Mormons should heed the counsel of Brigham Young and oppose unnecessary wars. And we as Americans in the world's leading democracy and superpower should continue to press for the use of nonviolent economic and political force to bring about solutions to world problems. Even a necessary war is not a good one, and we haven't had a necessary war for a very, very long time in this country. Our speaker hopes that in future we'll have thinking wars. I would hope for thinking strategies that would prevent war. Thanks.
We have time for questions and answers now. I would ask the responders to repeat the question before you respond to it.
You state that they needed to go to war because of the calendar situation, because of Ramadan coming up, and because they might lose the Arab allies. I think the first is a rather spurious reason, kind of a strange reason for going to war and killing people because it's because of the season situation. Why not wait till Ramadan was well underway? And your answer to that would be the Arabs might fall apart. Saudi Arabia had no place to go. I mean, Saudi Arabia was with us and with us for the duration, and certainly Kuwait was. There was no place, nothing that they would even consider doing other than following through with us. And Egypt and the others, all of them fear an insurgent Iraq, an Iraq that would be a major power in the Arab world. All of them feared Saddam Hussein and Iraq. I don't think there was any evidence, real evidence, that the Arabs would have fallen away. I don't believe that that I know that was said. It was said from the very beginning of the coalition, we've got to be careful, we've got to keep Israel out of it, and so forth. I don't think the coalition would have fallen apart. There's one country that might have, and that would be Syria, and I doubt that they would have, particularly after they saw what happened with Jordan. That was for a very short while. The embargo had only been on for a short time.
Just before hostilities.
That was still a very short time. You know, people in the Arab world store food. They just normally store food, and particularly the people of Iraq who'd gone through an 8-year war and had times, months at a time, when you couldn't buy sugar. Other months when you couldn't buy cooking oil and things like that. So that an embargo, you know, are we to say then that if an embargo doesn't work for 6 months or for 3 months, that then an embargo doesn't work? Very little. No, the figures now that have come out are much less than what we were told. And many of the things that were on the radio, on the television...
You're second-guessing those people who had to make those decisions at that time.
No, I'm not the only one second-guessing. There are a lot of people who recommended against the war, experts who recommended against the war, and there have been a lot of now new information come out that indicate that the situation wasn't as bad in Kuwait. They were not killing babies in Kuwait hospitals. Like we were told, and that was not true. A lot of those kinds. I'm not saying that it wasn't a terrible thing for Kuwait to have to go through. But
the delay was costing them coming to port.
Delay was costing a tremendous amount of the oil output, and it was causing problems for Kuwaitis. There's no question of that. But, you know, my own view, and I said this before the war, is that I didn't believe that, given the entire history and the behavior of Kuwait, that it was worth one American life. And I still feel that.
Do you feel World War II was not a necessary war?
Yes, it was a necessary war, absolutely. It was necessary for Europe when Hitler marched, and it was necessary for the United States when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. Absolutely, it was necessary.
The one since?
The one since?
Yeah, how
about... you know, I don't know enough about the Korean situation to say. My own view is that it probably wasn't necessary, but that was a part of the Cold War situation which was difficult to... I think we should have done something about Korea, but what I would like to see, and what I think that we're now moving on toward, I hope, is to get the world together for non-military force, because there's a lot of force that's just as effective. It would have been far more effective. For instance, when our hostages were taken in Iran, if we had been able to get Europe, if we had been able to get the kind of coalition that we got for the Gulf War together, and that was gotten together not for war, you know, that coalition was not put together to go to war. It was put together to impose a blockade on Iraq. If we'd gotten that kind of coalition together against Iran, we'd have gotten our hostages out in months. I'm convinced of that. I really am. And I think that the same is true of in Libya and other places. What we need is to be creative and use the kind of force that doesn't kill people. Eugene England, if you heard his presentation, you'd hear a lot of, in a sense, the way I feel about things. I think we're beyond war. We have proven to ourselves that wars don't work. They don't produce answers. They don't produce solutions.
Can I ask a question?
Yes. Excuse me, yes.
Do I have to repeat the whole question?
I think so.
I think you make very good points. In fact, I'm very much in agreement with a lot more very much of what Mr. Parker has to say, and as well as yourself. I hope I'm not sounding like I'm sidestepping the whole question, but in my paper, it is the purpose to look at the tactics used and look at the fact. I think it's very important, and I didn't get into that. You know, Sun Tzu talked a lot about the moral aspects of even getting into a war, and I didn't really address that. That is the first question, of course, is deciding whether to go to war, whether to start shedding blood or not to. And I think the best example there for me was Brigham Young, because the decision was made not to shed blood, but to use strategies which prevented the bloodshed to start, to keep the soldiers from going where they wanted them to go and coming into contact with him, preventing them from starting the war, from making the war. And I wasn't able to present this part of it, but I do discuss a little bit that Brigham Young did come to it. I believe, in looking at the statements made, that he came to the conclusion that the Mormon people were not permitted, were not authorized by the Lord to actually start a shooting war based on the Doctrine and Covenants instructions. I wish that all leaders would have that kind of insight and that kind of ingenuity and inspiration to be able to decide those kinds of things to begin with, and then if there is an aggressor that continues, that that they're able to take the proper response, and that's what I'm getting at. I really have a very big problem with the Persian Gulf War. I was against it in the beginning. I was interested in the way that I became interested in the way it was prosecuted, because it, you know, maybe intellectually or what have you, the similarities I saw with these other situations. But I do agree with you that, and I hope I didn't leave the impression that it's okay to go out and fight a war as long as you give that impression that you're trying to minimize casualties. I think that there is that question in the beginning as why you should be fighting to begin with.
One more.
I would like to ask both people, how would they define a necessary war?
That's not what my paper was about. that's very difficult.
Just saying there are none. But there are.
Yeah, tell you the truth, I haven't, you know, that's something that I have no actual conclusion on. I think that, I wish that there were someone like Brigham Young who would be able to tell us when, you know, what the Lord authorizes and what he doesn't.
What constitutes a necessary war? One that you cannot avoid, one that threatens you to the point where you must respond. Now, you can choose, of course, to respond in a non-warlike way. I mean, you can choose to simply be defeated, be captured, be whatever. But I think that, depending on how you want to interpret scriptures and how you want to interpret morality and how you want to interpret your own morality, you can come to the position of realizing that given all the mistakes we made leading up to World War II, and the fact is we were then confronted with a situation which demanded a response, and it had to be a forceful response because we had forces against us which were not any longer interested in any solutions, or reasons. Now, maybe Eugene England will challenge that.
Right.
Well, I think we can all believe that in a sense as part of our testimony of the gospel, but we live in the real world and the gospel does not move our leaders. And so we then perhaps have to realize, it seems to me, that there are necessary wars. What I would like to leave with is that there are unnecessary wars. There are situations that we ought to look at and realize that they cannot be solved by a war, number one. And number two, they're not worth a war. And number three, it's none of our business to go that far as to take other people's lives to correct that kind of situation. I would give you Vietnam. I would give you, Grenada and all of them. I mean, Panama and certainly the Gulf War. If we're going to correct the Gulf War, if we're going to correct Saddam Hussein's incursion into Kuwait, why didn't we correct the Israeli incursion into Lebanon, or the incursion of into East Timor, into a whole range of other things? We're very selective about these unnecessary wars. We don't fight all of them. We only fight those where we think that there's something in it for us. And that's not a reason to go to war.